Hi, this is Dominic Preziosi, editor of Commonweal. Charles Gallagher's new book, The Nazis of Copley Square, tells the largely forgotten story of the Christian Front, a group of armed Catholic militants that plotted a violent overthrow of the U.S. government in the 1940s. Our assistant editor, Regina Munch, talks to Charles Gallagher on this episode of the Commonweal Podcast. Hi, Regina.
Hi, Dominic.
It's good to see you today. So listen, this sounds like a really interesting topic. It's not something I'm familiar with. So maybe you could tell our audience a little bit about what you talked about.
Sure. I talked with Charles Gallagher, a historian at Boston College, about his new book called The Nazis of Copley Square. It's the story of a largely forgotten group called the Christian Front, a Catholic anti-Jewish group active in New York City and Boston in the 1930s and 40s. They were inspired and supported by Father Charles Coughlin, who our listeners may be familiar with, and the group in New York City stockpiled weapons that they stole from the military with a plan to overthrow the U.S. government. They were caught by the FBI, but the charges didn't stick. And after that, the group center then moved to Boston, where they ran anti-Jewish campaigns, and the leader even ended up becoming a covert agent for the Nazis. Gallagher had to do a lot of digging over the course of a decade to even get this story. He had to work with the FBI, to go through German archives, even some sources at the Vatican to understand this story, which hasn't really been known until now.
Okay, so let's take a listen.
Charles Gallagher, welcome to the Commonweal Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Regina. It's really great to be here. So Father Charles Coughlin was, in my view, the first celebrity priest in American history. He was a priest that had a radio show with about 30 million listeners. And many historians have written about Coughlin. There are a number of different excellent biographies on Father Coughlin. But those histories were never really able to dig deeply into what, in my view, was a paramilitary organization called the Christian Front. And Coughlin was the inspirational leader for this movement. There was a public side to the Christian Front. It had anywhere from 30,000 members to 100,000 members between 1938 and 1942. And the Christian Front had this public side of public activism, but it also had paramilitary sections. And the paramilitary sections were the ones that were arming themselves and headquartered in Brooklyn in late 1939. They were making bombs in their basement and caching weapons. And most of the ordinary members, the public members of the Christian Front, did not know that these paramilitary wings existed. And the leaders of those of the paramilitary wings became, in my view, the foot soldiers of Father Coughlin. They were connected deeply to Coughlin's anti-communism and decided to arm themselves based on Coughlin's inspiration that global communism, which Coughlin equated with Judaism, in other words, Coughlin's theology of Judaism intertwined secular Judaism with communism and Bolshevism, and that because of communist persecutions of Catholics in both Mexico and Spain, Coughlin thought that the Catholics ought to form their own front, and he called it the Christian Front, and that they should duly arm themselves in order to take up a revolution, to thwart the revolution that he saw coming under communism. And he saw his right-wing zealots, his foot soldiers, as taking up arms in legitimate defense of Roman Catholicism, frankly.
You devote some space in the book to the trends in Catholic theology at the time and how they inspired and helped legitimize the Christian Front. Could you explain?
Yeah, it's a history book. So I write about the theological tenets at the time that were dominant, particularly mystical body of Christ theology and Catholic action. And I argue in the book that both of these theologies that were dominant at the time, but largely unknown today, they were legitimate Catholic theologies that, in my view, gave a level of permission, of moral permission, for the Christian Front not only to exist, but to become activated towards the views of Coughlin on what he viewed as legitimate defense. And so, for example, mystical body of Christ theology grounded in kind of the Pauline notion of the part to the whole, the head to the body, that if Catholics were being persecuted in Spain or in Mexico or any other place in the globe, being physically harmed, that the body of Christ, which was global and transnational, that the Catholics in Boston were harmed just as much as Catholics in Barcelona when their church was bombed. And Catholic Action itself was a similar ecclesiology started in the early 1920s. That was started as a sort of social uplift movement connected to social justice in a way, but always controlled by the clergy. And so it's lay people in coordination with their clergy doing any kind of work that is deemed charitable. It eventually begins to take on an anti-communist tone by the early to mid-1930s. And so when the Christian Front establishes itself in 1939, as they profess as a legitimate religious organization, they take up the defense that they're doing Catholic Action, that because they are aggressively anti-communist, this fits into what the clergy, the Roman Catholic clergy in the United States, deem as appropriate. And so they're also just doing Catholic Action by taking up arms against this threat that they see on the horizon in global communism.
You focus on two leaders in the Christian Front, John Cassidy in New York City and Francis Moran in Boston. And you talk a lot about the kinds of actions they undertook as leaders and some of the differences between the two groups and what they focused on. Could you tell me about those men?
John Cassidy is the leader of the Christian Front in Brooklyn. He's the head paramilitarist of the New York Christian Front. He is a dropout from St. John's Law. Actually, he's a graduate of St. John's Law School, but he couldn't pass the bar in three tries. He's an aggressive and devout Catholic who becomes radicalized towards anti-communism, joins with Coughlin, and becomes a disciple of Coughlin. And Coughlin activates him to be his kind of local paramilitarist in New York. And he's the one who does all of the recruiting of the paramilitarists who will eventually be arrested by the FBI in January of 1940. He's thoroughly convinced that Judaism was present at the creation of communism, that Marx's paternal grandfather was a Jew, that Lenin had Jewish lineage, and consequently, this new political philosophy, which in his view is an expansionistic secular religion, is an existential threat to Roman Catholicism, and in its political manifestations is trying to wipe out Catholicism around the globe. And he is a working class organizer, very articulate. He's not all that intellectual, but he's a motivational public speaker and an incredible organizer. When his group is arrested by the FBI and put on trial into the spring and fall of 1940, when they are acquitted, the New York branch is shut down and the movement moves to Boston, where an equally energetic, much more intellectual, and much better organizer named Francis Moran will take the reins. He also is anointed by Coughlin to be the public voice in Boston of the Christian Front. Coughlin is recruiting these men as foot soldiers, but he's off and away in the distance. He never has his fingertips connected to the hands of either Moran and Cassidy, but he knows that they are ideological compatriots and that they will undertake what is best for his movement.
How do we know that these men were working with Coughlin and fulfilling his vision?
So we know that Cassidy was anointed by Coughlin because in a open-air meeting of almost 10,000 people in Philadelphia in 1939, the Christian Front piped in Father Coughlin over shortwave radio to address the crowd. And in that meeting, he commissioned John Cassidy to become the leader of the Christian Front in New York. And there was great celebration at that meeting, and Cassidy took his position very seriously and immediately started recruiting on the paramilitary side. It was really Cassidy's blessing from Father Coughlin that gives him the energy to carry through with his plot to try to overthrow the government of the United States, which he felt was being infiltrated by Jewish communists whom President Roosevelt was peppering through his cabinet and through other governmental positions in his administration.
You dive into the story of Francis Moran, who over the course of a few years actually becomes an unregistered foreign agent working for the Nazis. How did that happen?
So we know that Francis Moran is also commissioned by Father Coughlin to become his leader in Boston. We know that because the previously classified FBI file mentions that the Boston Police Department found a letter during an illegal search of the Christian Front's offices at the Copley Square Hotel in downtown Boston, which is where the title of the book comes from, The Nazis of Copley Square. So the Boston Police Department, in an illegal search, actually took the letter that commissioned Moran, the commissioning letter from Coughlin. And that letter has been destroyed. We have a reference to it only in the classified documents, but I haven't been able to locate it in the archives. But we know that at about the same time Cassidy was commissioned in Philadelphia, Moran was equally commissioned by letter in 1939 to become the leader in Boston. And what emerges is that the Christian Front changed its stripes in Boston, and they decided to go with espionage over terrorism. The New York branch was connected to terrorism. That plot failed. And so as it moves to Boston and gains steam in Boston through 1939 through 1942, they are going to be engaging in espionage activity with a Nazi SS officer who is in Boston under diplomatic cover. And so starts a second life of the Christian Front, this time in Boston.
One reason you give for why we don't remember all of this, particularly Catholics don't remember some of this history, is because the religious motivation for the Christian Front's actions were covered up, particularly in the New York trial. I'm going to read a quote of yours back to you. Quote, "The actions of the Christian Front were every bit a result of their values, and their values were Catholic through and through." Could you explain?
Well, basically, the Christian Front is an embarrassment for two institutions. They're an embarrassment for the Roman Catholic Church, mainly because their activities are violating the law of love found in the gospel. And they're equally an embarrassment for the U.S. government because of the way that they were able to circumvent any prosecution and also vigorously carry out espionage for the Nazis without ever being detected. So there's that. But your question now is about how are they authentically Catholic? And they're authentically Catholic as they violate the law of love in the Gospels. They're authentically Catholic in a number of ways. For example, they're uniquely universalist when it comes to race. This defies the contemporary narrative. They do not have any sense of white supremacy. The Christian Front engages in recruitment campaigns in Harlem. They have members of their group who are African American. They have inspirational leadership from African American fascists. They readily engage with African Americans, mainly because they believe that it is anti-Semitism, which is the prime motivator for them, but not Nazi racialism. And it's precisely because of their Catholicism that baptism, Catholic baptism, is a universal, sacramental, indelible mark that is supra-racial. And consequently, if you are a Catholic, a baptized Catholic, your race doesn't matter. They become colorblind. This is a narrative that we can't understand in the contemporary style, but it's precisely because of their Catholic theology. The other component, which many today will find difficult for their ears, is that these right-wing religious philosophers, in a way, were touting human rights. They were the first Catholics to tout a notion of human rights. Father Coughlin, in his 16 principles, his 16 points for his program to join the National Union of Social Justice and eventually the Christian Front, his last point was about human rights. To have human rights talk be engaged in the early to mid-1930s is extraordinary. So this is not to be confused with their anti-Semitism. And they don't engage in a Hitlerian style of anti-Semitism until right before they go underground, I must say. But their view is that Roman Catholic theology permits anti-Semitism because of the teaching on the deicide, that Jesus Christ was crucified and died at the express mechanical action of the Jews. And they see not only that Jews are present at the founding of communism itself, but that Jews are responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. And this is in many ways, a baked-in anti-Semitism. This notion of the deicide, the killing of Christ, is baked into their worldview. And it's a theologically informed style of anti-Semitism, which really merges into racial anti-Semitism and mimics Nazi racial anti-Semitism precisely because they have such traction with this notion of Jews as Christ killers. And that's how they justify their anti-Semitic public position.
We'll have more of Regina's conversation with Charles Gallagher in a minute. If you like what you're hearing, I'd like to encourage you to rate and review the Commonweal Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or on whichever platform you use to get your podcasts. And please, if you have friends who like podcasts, tell them about us. Your reviews help us bring these conversations to new listeners. And if you haven't already, consider making a one-time or recurring donation. Your support helps make this work possible. Just see our donate link on the Commonweal website.
How were members of the clergy involved in the Christian Front, and how was their presence a legitimizing factor for the Christian Front?
This is a good question, and I'll answer it with an anecdote from the archives. I was able to go over to Harvard Divinity School archives, and they had the papers of a Protestant theologian named Paul Tillich. And I had noticed that he had written an essay that was unpublished, and his essay was about Catholicism and anti-Judaism. And I was astonished to find that in that unpublished essay, he devotes a number of paragraphs and a number of lines to the Christian Front. And in a sense, there's this whole section of that essay, which is Tillich giving a theological discourse on what he believes to be the greatest threat to democracy in 1939 and 1940. And to him, it's the Christian Front. And he says that the Christian Front is a religious threat, and it's a threat to Roman Catholicism precisely because of the position of priests. And in this essay, he's arguing that if priests get involved with the Christian Front, because the Christian Front is ostensibly a lay movement, and Tillich argues that if the Christian Front becomes dominated by priests or activated by priests in some way, then they will become much more ruthless and much more insidious, and that what is considered anti-Judaism from a religious sense has the real possibility of merging into anti-Semitism. And that's exactly what happens. The leaders of the Christian Front, the lay leaders, Moran and Cassidy, rely on two priests from New York, a philosopher named Edward Brophy and a lawyer named Edward Lodge Curran. And those priests, who are both very well educated, they give advice behind the scenes, both theological and philosophical and legal advice behind the scenes, again, to these Coughlin foot soldiers. And it's because of their position in what Tillich sees as the officer class of the church that gives them both motivation and sanction to keep doing what they're doing.
Who stood in opposition to the Christian Front, particularly from a Catholic standpoint?
There was in Boston a young woman reporter who was very civil rights oriented, very human rights oriented, and her name was Frances Sweeney. She's known locally in Boston as an icon of civil liberties and human rights advocacy. She's not well known nationally. She ran a small newspaper called the Boston City Reporter. She was a Catholic. She was a liberal Catholic. She had communist leanings. In fact, she worked for a communist, Granville Hicks, who was the first communist hired at Harvard University. She was his secretary. By 1939 and 1940, she is of the opinion that anti-Semitism on the part of Catholics is a sin and should be stopped. And she becomes quite anti-Coughlin and anti-Christian Front, and she ends up taking the charge against the Christian Front in Boston and nationally. Also, it's that energy against the Christian Front was harnessed by British intelligence, who recruited Frances Sweeney to be the leader of a front organization, which was entirely sponsored by MI6, the military intelligence of British intelligence. So Sweeney's energy against the Christian Front was also meeting British national interests, because the British at that time in the fall of 1940, the bombing of Britain was on, and the Americans hadn't yet joined the war, and they saw Sweeney as someone who could meet their interests. And so they clandestinely recruited her, and she became an unwitting agent of MI6, really up until, it seems to me, we can track her as receiving payment from the British through 1943.
That's a really fascinating undercurrent of your book. It's almost inadvertent, revealing how much international spy agencies were active in the United States before it entered World War II, trying to sway public opinion. The FBI and the Boston Police Department do not come out looking good in your story.
No, I think there are reasons for that. The FBI is in its infancy. They've never done counterintelligence work. The officer who was assigned to Boston had cut his teeth on the John Dillinger case, so he was really focused on catching bank robbers and auto thieves. He really knew nothing about counterintelligence. And Scholes, before he came to Boston, was working with Rudolf Hess, who was the deputy Führer, but also known as Hitler's intelligence chief. And he was really well trained in intelligence and recruitment of agents when he arrived in Boston.
What parallels do you see between the Christian Front and today's far-right groups in terms of their beliefs or their tactics?
In the back of my mind, when I listen to the news and the January 6th commission is in the news, I always think about the Christian Front case from 1940. And my sense is that the state at that time did not take this group as seriously as they should have. There's a lot of anti-globalization impulse. There's a nationalism impulse. There is an anti-left-wing impulse in the broader scope of the January 6th incidents. There's also some anti-Semitic impulse in that the reporting of the Wall Street Journal on levels of anti-Semitism within the January 6th insurrectionists was an excellent piece of reporting, I thought. So there are these kind of impulses that still seem to be working their way into the headlines today that also were quite present in the 1940s. I think the interesting point is that the history of the right is attenuated at best, that historians have basically forgotten the history of the right. They felt uncomfortable writing about it professionally because they didn't want to give it credibility. Much also of the history of the right is a history of the Christian right. And because of the dominance of the Marxist critique since the 1960s within the professional historical circles, Marxists are queasy about writing about religion. To understand the Christian Front, you've got to understand Pauline theology, for example. You really have to know that stuff. You have to know what mystical body of Christ theology means internally to these people who are picking up rifles in order to save the country, in their view.
How did you become interested in this relatively little known story to begin with, and how did you know where to look to uncover it?
Yeah, so I became interested in this group when I was in undergrad classes at Marquette. I took some courses on national security history with Professor Ethan Theoharis, who was a famous historian of the FBI. And I really loved his classes. And as I did some research, we had each student has to write a 10-page research paper at the end of the course. I found this group, the Christian Front, just in the newspapers, and I saw pictures of them holding rifles and some of their bombs that they had made. And what was interesting as well to me was at the same time when I was an undergraduate, I was a police officer for the summer in my hometown, Nantucket, Massachusetts. So we had a summer home there, and I joined the police force. So I was getting trained on semi-automatic weaponry. I was getting trained on tactics and how to even use a shotgun, things like that. And so when I saw these guys holding their Springfield 903 rifles and attempting to overthrow the government, I thought it was a really interesting story. It also seemed to go against everything I was reading in my history books, that American Catholics in the 1930s and 40s were finally proving their patriotism, and they were becoming accepted in Catholic society because President Roosevelt himself was appointing Catholics to important positions in the U.S. government. And so the idea that a bunch of armed Catholics were trying to overthrow the country seemed really interesting to me. Fast forward 10 years during graduate school, I was helping my father clean out his basement, and he had his father, so my grandfather's scrapbook from the 1930s, and I was flipping through that, and he had newspaper clippings about the Christian Front case and how the FBI had swooped down and arrested 17 men armed with weapons and bombs and machine guns. Historians through the years said this was nothing more than a playful plot, that the Christian Front didn't matter. And when I was finishing my first book called Vatican Secret Diplomacy back in 2009, they came up again. I was looking into diplomatic archives connected to the Vatican. And sure enough, all of a sudden, I see that in the Vatican Secretary of State, the Cardinal Secretary of State, the Pope, they seem to be writing notes. They're very interested about what these Catholics in Brooklyn are on trial for. To be accused of overthrowing a government is, as St. Thomas Aquinas says, it's a very grave sin. It's especially grave sin. The whole Gospel of Luke is basically constructed around trying not to overthrow the local government. And so then I said, when I was finishing up my last book, I said, I really got to track this group down. I went to the National Archives. They insisted that no FBI record existed. They said, unless you have a case number, we have no record of this group even existing. So I started searching around, and I did a deep dive on the internet. I went into this site called Reddit, which some of your listeners may know, but there was this kind of, I don't know if they were neo-Nazis or what, but some of them had this FBI case number that seemed to look like what I needed. In other words, the letters and the numbers lined up. And there was one remark that said, oh, that's from the Christian Front. So I actually just took this number from Reddit and went back to the National Archives. And I said, can you look at for this case number? And they came back and they said, wow, actually, we do have that case, but you have to talk to the FBI about it. And when I started talking to the FBI on the telephone, it was three different telephone negotiations. And I finally asked them, I said, why are we having all these phone conversations about getting this file released? And they said, Professor Gallagher, the file you're requesting is one of the largest in our inventory. To put it in perspective, it's as big as the file on Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And it's going to take some devotion of resources and agents to declassify the file to get it to you. And I got to give the credit that the declassification department at Langley was terrific. I also had to get files released on the Nazi who was in Boston, Herbert Scholes, and on Francis Moran. Each time I requested a file, I had to wait between 18 months and 2 years to get the file released. So altogether, that's why it took about 10 years to write this book, because as I went along, I realized, well, I've really got to get this guy's file released and another of this person's file released. And it took about 2 years to turn. So I really had to be persistent, but I also had to be patient in getting the files released.
You write that after Vatican II, and particularly after Nostra Aetate, quote, the Church of Francis Moran was being displaced by the Church of Francis Sweeney, Moran being the leader of the Boston Christian Front and Sweeney the progressive Catholic organizing against him. After spending a decade with this story, what do you think the church can learn from it?
Yeah, so I think Francis Moran was a very angry individual whose anger could be ostensibly bolstered by the Catholicism of the day. The kind of view of Jews among Catholics was present in biblical exegesis of the time. It was present in the church's prayers of the time. It was present in many of the leadership understanding of who Jews were. And except for pockets, both within the Vatican and in local churches, there was no unified position yet on Catholic-Jewish relations, and particularly whether or not anti-Semitism was a sin for Catholics. And this is why Francis Sweeney becomes the precursor of Vatican II in that regard. And so by the time of Nostra Aetate, the theologians and the cardinals and the people who are tasked with formulating official teachings of the church, they had moved to place anti-Semitism on the table of Catholic sinfulness and were able to tag it as a sin. There's one issue here, though. One of the great, I think, or the important aspects of this Christian Front book is that the Catholics I look at are street-level Catholics. They're ordinary Catholics, and they're working-class Catholics. And only because the intelligence agencies were surveilling them so heavily do we get their verbatim sense of who they are. But I see the challenge now is closing the gap between street-level Catholicism and that 30,000-foot view of official teaching, and that we still need to have a sense of Catholic-Jewish relations and connection to anti-Semitism at the street level. That I think at the level of official teaching, that Frances Sweeney predominates, and she's won that. But I still worry about the street-level view. I still worry that the people like Francis Moran might not be getting that teaching down to the pew or down to the level of the neighborhood. And so we see reflections of anti-Semitism in today's political life in the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, for example. How can the church be more vocal in illuminating this beautiful teaching about the relationship between Catholics and Jews as we go forward? That's really my hope for this book, that it'll help change some minds and help encourage further work to be done at the street level when it comes to Catholic anti-Semitism.
Charles Gallagher's book is The Nazis of Copley Square, The Forgotten Story of the Christian Front, and it's available now from Harvard University Press. This is Dominic Preziosi for the Common Wheel Podcast. The Common Wheel Podcast is produced by assistant editor Griffin Olenek and the Common Wheel staff in partnership with Sandberg Media. Wally Boudway composed the music, and David Dalt did the editing. For the Common Wheel Podcast, this is Dominic Preziosi.